Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
Hello everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank Karen and the organizing committee for inviting me, and I'm delighted to be here. This is a talk for a wider audience, a non-philosophy audience, as Karen has suggested to me, and it is on self and world in Indian philosophy. Now, the title of the talk is, or the subtitle is, Consciousness as Intimacy, Truth as Taste. And I'd like you to simply think about this, about consciousness as your own consciousness, because what we will find in Indian philosophy, early Indian philosophy, is that it's an introspective investigation, what's called a first personal investigation of consciousness. So the title is Consciousness is Intimacy, and that intimacy is the tasting of consciousness, of the phenomenological, the experiential qualities of consciousness itself, and that is a source of great joy if you can access that through whatever sort of means of knowledge as well as through other means, aesthetic means and experiential means, for example, even meditation, hence the title of the talk, because the reason why I'm looking at it in this way is because of a certain feeling of lack in philosophy. Now, the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben has spoken about a fracture in the history of Western philosophy. It's a fracture between knowledge and pleasure. And he says that only such a pleasure in which pleasure and knowledge are united could attain to the ideal of wisdom and thus taste the flavor of truth or reality. So he's trying to consider this merging of what's normally called philosophy, a very cognitive cerebral exercise, and aesthetics, which is about taste and so on. And he quotes a passage at the end of his book called Taste, from an aesthetic philosophy text, classical philosophy text, called The Mirror of Composition. And this says that arising from the luminous principle indivisible, now the luminous principle is, of course, the luminosity of consciousness. The metaphor of luminosity or light is frequently used in Indian philosophy and other philosophies because consciousness reveals objects in the world. Cognition, cognitive consciousness, is what reveals a world of objects, a world of tastes, of properties, of qualities. If we are sleeping, or if we're dead, and there is no cognitive consciousness, there is no world of qualities, of experience. So the light of cognition, the light of cognitive consciousness, is this luminous principle, indivisible, self-evident, made of joy and thought together. Such is the flavor, the capital F, that those who have the means of judgment enjoy as the proper form of self. Now, self here is used as the first person reflexive pronoun, I, in that sense. It refers to me. This is my consciousness, which is also this great expanse of the world. So if we think for a moment, I'd like you to simply think in this way, that when we wake up in the morning, we see this vast world. It's a world that we are conscious of. It's a world of experience. And when they speak about the luminosity of consciousness, it's in the space of luminosity, the space of experience, that everything arises. What we think of as mind, as matter, senses, sort of sensory tastes, solidity, liquidity, loudness, hotness, which are then demarcated as various kinds of objects. This world of differentiation, of a variety of tastes, a plurality of sensation, emotion, and so on, arises within a space of consciousness. And this space of consciousness, the space of experience in the Indian tradition, especially in early Indian philosophy, is called world, called loka. And they want to experience this world, which is a world of everything that we experience, and in which we sort of demarcate ourselves, identify ourselves as this individual body, as this individual self. Okay. Now, the text we'll be looking at, and we cannot, we'll be skimming, we'll be summarizing these texts in 50 minutes, is the Vedas, and Ved means truth, knowledge, which is about 1200 BCE. The Brahmanas and the root Bra has to do with vastness, enormous spaciousness, expansion. And so this is really, again, through knowledge and again this inquiry or into this vastness of what is reality and truth, and the early Upanishads. Upanishad literally means it's looking at the connections between self and world, between person and world, the individual and the world. Because think for a moment, when we wake up, and this is the easiest way to put it across, what arises is both the sense of the individual, a perception of the individual and the perception of the world, more or less together. There is a kind of a synchronic and diachronic in space and time, and arising of these two every time we wake up, right? Or if we faint and we wake up, so to speak. And also with birth. Now, what are the links in virtue of which, the links between world and person, in virtue of which this arising is possible? These are called homological links. We'll talk about what that means in a second, but they're investigating these links by which the person and world are arising. And they investigate, and I think it's proper to say that it is philosophy, and I use Wilfred Sellers' marvelous definition of philosophy, which is how things in the widest possible sense of the word hang together in the widest possible sense of the world. And I think that every culture and society does look at, consider how things hang together. Right? And in the case of the early Indians, they're looking at the nature of the world, how it arises and comes to be, its origins, the nature of the self, which at a sort of more primordial level is also mind and body. We'll differentiate these as we go along. They look at the arising of cognition, of cognitive consciousness, when there is a world of experience. And they say it is with the arising of cognitive consciousness, with the arise of cognitive consciousness, with knowing, with cognition, that we have being and existence. It's only with cognition that we can identify things as objects which exist or do not exist. Where there is no cognition, there is nothing of which we can say this exists or does not exist. So this is a very experientially based philosophy with a tremendous amount, nevertheless, of empirical work, verification, measurements of the world and so on and so forth, of the individual and how and so on. But why that is the case, we'll come to in a minute. This philosophical discourse, this inquiry, proceeds as questions and answers in a sphere of public philosophical competition. It's a philosophy competition. It's a very serious one. If you happen to lose, you could lose your head, literally. You could have your head chopped off. Yeah. You could also have economic losses. You could lose 1,000 cows and so on and so forth. So this is a forum which is adjudicated. You win or lose. You have to play by the rules in a highly structured environment. It's a physically structured environment, and the physical representations there are a reminder, they're a measurement of the universe and also a measurement of yourself as a person. I cannot explain the entire thing, but shall we say that it is a highly structured, highly formatted forum in which certain rules govern this philosophical discourse. A huge number of assumptions are made. There's a philosophy behind it. There is a practice behind it. And there are rules for adjudicating who has won and lost. And a philosophical adjudication was sometimes a form of political adjudication. And this continued in later philosophy, where you could have a shift in the ideologues, you know, who were the advisors to a king and so on, according to who won philosophical debates. So it was a very good way of settling matters, yeah, which continued. It saved them a fight. Because philosophy was a competition, and it was a very serious one in which you could lose your life. Now, so what are the aims of this philosophy? So they're investigating the world, its arising origins, and the arising of the person and self. not simply for the sake of a cerebral exercise. They have rather larger aims in mind. They want to remake the world, remake the self. They want to create a more beautiful world of experience, more beautiful bodies, bodies of truth, through these philosophical exercises, what Pierre Hadot has called spiritual exercises. They're embodied exercises, enactive exercises. They bring something into being through the very process of cognitive activity, right? That sort of thing. This is a philosophy in which is inactive and embodied. And this is quite important. It's a philosophy which is without substances, entities, things. There are no objects in the sense of a substance to start with. We do not have a pre-given world, a pre-ordered world. What they say is that the arising of the world is a kind of activity, it's an inaction. The world is brought into being, it is self-generated, and how this is the case, we'll look at in a minute. So it's a philosophy without things, activities, substances. What they have are capacities, functions, and activities. Right? These powers, these activities, these functions are what end up constituting the world and constituting the person. They make up our minds and our bodies. We'll come to this in a minute. It is an inactivist philosophy. It is by virtue of the actualization of these capacities, these cognitive capacities and activities, that the world appears as it does, and we appear to ourselves as we do and to each other as we do. To understand what is meant here, we need to consider three core categories, three terms, three assumptions. The first is the nature of consciousness, the second is the nature of the world, and the third is the relation between the individual and the world, between person and world and self and world. The first term is something which in Sanskrit Sanskrit is translated as the one or self or this vastness of truth. In our terminology in English, it is perhaps best translated as consciousness. Translated as awareness, but it's not just consciousness. It is consciousness which has power. It's a source of power. There is an energy there, which is not physical energy, not a mental energy. There is a stuff there, but it is not the stuff of mentality or materiality. It's something prior to mind and something which is non-conceptual. And this is what they're going to investigate in the end. The reason why this reality or truth is called the one is because it denotes both the origin of the world from that which is prior to space and time, prior to mind and matter, as well as the manifest world of mind and matter. So we have this paradox where what is true, what is real, this world that we experience and ourselves as experience, is something which is both undivided, seamless, but which seems to be divided and to be differentiated, to be substantive, right? This is solid. This is liquid. We can feel it, right? We cut our hands, blood will spill. So this experience, and very empirical and verifiable experience, is real in us, is absolutely real. And yet, it's somehow seamless, undivided, according to what they're saying. So, and the reason for this, and I'll give the game away here, is of course because everything is made of that stuff which continues to be constitutive, to make up, to fabricate all these material and mental things, our bodies and so on, right? So cognition, this differentiation, is arising from something which is not substantial, right? It's not that this is an illusion, it's just that it is a kind of consciousness power stuff. Let's call it that. It's very unwieldy to call it that, but we really don't have much choice. So this is the power of consciousness through which everything manifests, but it is that same thing which is before, within, throughout this entire experience. It's the same stuff. So this is the first verse of the Nasadiya Sutra, which we had. And Nasadiya means not non-existence. These are the well-spoken verses, because philosophy has to be spoken well. We cannot simply do PowerPoint. It has to be aesthetic, poetic. It must convey the truth in the right way. Otherwise, we will never learn the truth. Truth is also a felt phenomenon, right? It is not simply something like the writing with equations. That has its place. For making the measurements, defining the space in which philosophy occurs. But philosophy is felt. It is felt both cognitively. At some point we come to know, but then after that we must experience it phenomenologically. The reality of whatever is being spoken about is a felt experience, is a bodily experience, because the body is the mind, is constituted of cognitive powers. We'll come to that in a minute. Okay. So the non-existent did not exist at that point, at that origin, nor did the existent exist at that point. They say at that time, but this is the limitations of language. This is before space and time. So this is the beginning, which is an origin. And we cannot say of it that it exists or it does not exist. Why? Because there is no cognition. And hence, as we said, there are no cognitive objects about which we can say there is existence or non-existence. Right? So this is not nothing. It is a void, but it's only devoid of or empty of objects, of cognizable objects. They come into being together with cognition. Cognition and its objects are not separable, right? Subject and object are not separable. Mind and matter are not separable. They come to be at a later stage, to speak, right? And the void, we'll find out, this is what we're going to be investigating and see. This is this kind of empty wholeness, which is all pervasive. And empty only because it's non-cognitive and non-conceptual. This is nevertheless a reality which is that felt awareness. And we spoke of this at the beginning, that if we investigate ourselves within a very well-defined interactive environment philosophically, right? Set of rules, so on and so forth, set of concepts and so on and so forth, then we can come to this deeper knowledge, this deeper truth, we can taste it. And it is very intimately the intimacy of our own real self, our own awareness. Right? So we all have access to it, but this underlying awareness is not personal, it's completely universal, impersonal. It's that which is the stuff of this entire world, as well as this body and mind. That's the sort of idea. The world is also the one made of the same stuff. It's the world of cognition, the space of experience, the space of qualities. And what they want to try and do, the aim is, of course, to refabricate, to remake the qualities of experience. So you have a better life. You have a more beautiful life. And in fact, you can go beyond the disintegrative nature, you know, because life is disintegration. That's the nature of life and of the world. It comes to be, it goes away. There's a constant hunger. We're always filling up. We desire all these cognitive tastes. We're constantly filling up. And the interesting thing is that cognition is not just with your senses or just thinking with the mind. These faculties are throughout your body, even breathing, respiration. These are in some sense cognitive, you know. As our breath changes, everything changes. Locomotion is something through which we come to know the world as well, right? So all of these things which we take to be non-cognitive, nevertheless interact with the environment, give us our bearings, and give us a certain experience of the world, right? The way we move, the way our space is structured, the way we think, the way we feel, the way we breathe, for example, right? The way we hold our bodies, the tensions in them, all of these things shape our experience, what we think we are, what we think the world is. Even social classes, right? Who's, so many things. So that's what they're talking about. So they want to recompose the world. The world and the individual are compositions. And when I was thinking about this, there are no things, no substances. There are only capacities, powers, activities. How is this possible? Well, think of a musical composition. We can get some feedback on that. We have the notes, the musical notes, right? From Do, Re, Mi, or Sarigamapa, whichever one you want to take. Now, the composition only takes on life It only becomes existence when those notes are strung together and they're vocalized, when they're acted out, right? The doing is the making, right? And we find and we make at the same time. And that is the sort of way that they are thinking about cognition and world. This is happening all the time, because remember, it's coming from before space and time. So it's a ceaseless activity in space and time, from the perspective of space and time. And what they're looking at, the reason why it's undivided, is because it's perspectival. When you look at it from the point of view of space and time, in various ways, you see the world in a particular way. If you're completely in a state of, well, in today's world, it would be deep meditation, for example, your attention is totally turned inward, self-attention, you will experience this kind of joyful intimacy. When it's turned outward, you see this world in various ways. As your attention and your intentions change over time, you have a different perspective. You might see things in a more fluid, beautiful way. You might be feeling happy. Your entire cognitive structure changes, right? You're high. Somebody has had a lot to drink and so on. It's different. The examples that they give, for example, of the truth is actually sexual union. And we used to do this at Reading quite frequently in one of our classes, that this is, for example, a place where the mind, the conceptualizing mind, begins to dissolve. It sort of ceases, it withdraws. And then you're in that realm of truth and tasting. When we listen to a beautiful piece of music, right? We're totally sort of merged with that music. We lose those boundaries, and there is just that listening, that beauty, and so on. Because subject and object, all these divisions of normal cognition have to a degree ceased, and we can appreciate that taste, that aesthetic taste. So their view of cognition is that, yes, they are totally wedded to the idea of measurement, verification, and in fact they go on and on about it in various ways. It's very important to measure out the world. You cannot come to this deeper knowledge, this deeper tasting, without these measures, because that's the only way you can find the links within the world outside, which allow it to be this masterpiece, this work of beauty. And you need to know the links, the measures, through which you can develop this within yourself and through interacting with the world. So the measurements are very important. This is not just a purely, it is an aesthetic exercise, but it's one in which science and art meet, mathematics and art meet. And this is, of course, the measures are these homological connections. Now, homology, if we think about it, I mean, it's used in biology and so on, but here, I would like you to think about the relation between part and whole a little bit. Normally, you know, we have a way of thinking in spatial terms, discrete spatial units, and how these parts make up a whole. Supposing you start thinking temporally, organically, the way that life comes to be. Life is time. It's not something static. And this is how they're thinking. And it's when we were talking about a musical composition, how are the parts strung together temporally to form a whole? These are, in some sense, aesthetic but temporal parts. Now, this is something, these homological links and the relationships between part and whole, needs a lot of investigation. We barely scratch the surface of how people are really thinking then. But this is the kind of idea. That this coming to be, how these parts are related to each other, how they're related to the whole, how different wholes are related, how this happens over time. There are synchronic connections, but there are also diachronic connections, and these must be measured and they must be learnt if the truth is to be found, and we are going to go beyond the surface of life, of cognition, of action, and so on, of ethics. Okay. So when we enact, and this is quite an amazing idea, it took me a while to understand, when these cognitive powers come to be, they enact, for example, our sight, our hearing, and so on, but this is, we're not talking about personal ones, we're not talking about the individual entities. What they're saying is that the stuff of cognition, these cognitive abilities which we have, capacities as individuals, is in an impersonal way there in the world. We are constituted of the same stuff as the world. This stuff is ultimately something from which materiality and mentality all emerge, subject, object, self, other, all of this emerges. But this is an inaction. And when we look at And when we look at the way it arises, we find that these cognitive powers, they come forth in the very activity themselves. They name and they form themselves. They give themselves being. How this happens, we're going to come to in a minute. Just before, because this coming to be is a power, and we need to understand the nature of that power of consciousness through which all these cognitive powers can manifest and be present as subjects and objects, as a world of objects for a subject. So the second Davash goes, the one breathes. Now, you know, people are trying to use terms which will convey something which is non-conceptual. They're trying to give the non-conceptual conceptual form, first as the one, and then in terms of breath. So it's a breathing without wind. It's a breathing without really breathing, right? It's a movement. It's a power of force which is spilling out, which is coming out, right, which is manifesting. It's a bit like will in the sense that it's alive in some sense, right? There is an animate conception. It's not just sort of dead matter and arbitrary forces coming to being. There is a reflexivity here. It's self-regulating, like the way in which the living body is self-regulating. So they're using these metaphors to define the nature of this primordial power. Right? It's self-positing, reflexive, right? It turns back on itself. But the turning back on itself is what begins the process of cognition, the deepest layers. And the idea of talking about this, of describing this, is to elicit in the listener, who is an advanced practitioner, to investigate the arising of their own cognition, their own experience of the world. And to go back to how this reflexivity of consciousness and so on, consciousness power, is able to manifest as well, but it's not a personal power, it's impersonal. So as you go deeper into yourself, you access the impersonal, that which is not you, which is not just this mind and body, it's not just this world, but that from which they both arise. So anyway, this is this non-conceptual power. Now, the very process of self-positing, of coming to be, the initial activity, if you like, is also the instantiation, the coming to be of truth and order. Now, the idea of truth, of order, is something active, right? It's an activity. Everything is activity. So through this, so this activity is, it's ordered. In that sense, it's truthful, and it measures out this world of objects and subjects, this world of objects. It measures out this beauty of nature, the particular patterns of the constellations, the way they move about, the seasons, the way that, you know, the waves of the ocean move with the moon and so on. It's this work of beauty which is measured and ordered in certain ways, and we need to understand how it's ordered. Otherwise, we really cannot come to a real understanding of ourselves. We need to understand how the human body, mind, this mind, is ordered, and then how these are related. Not just externally, but internally. There are links at different levels, right? External but also internal, within, here, and without there. So this is quite a complex sort of a thing. And ethics has to do with aesthetics and science, looking, finding out these measures and being able to reconstitute oneself and the world by finding the right measures, right? The right correlations, and so on. And I think there is that there are close parallels in Western philosophy for this. Some others will know more about it. So, first we have the nameless, the non-cognitive, the non-conceptual, which of which we could say it neither exists nor it does not exist. But then there is this stirring, this movement, which is not really a movement in space and time, but which is a cognitive movement of self-reflection, of reflexivity. Reflexivity is you come to know yourself. There's a self-intimacy, a self-awareness, right? They call it an ocean. Why? It's an ocean where all cognitive tastes merge and from which they arise. It's an ocean of possibility. It's the ocean of mind. Of mind before it differentiates into mentality and materiality. Okay. Devoid of objectivity, it's a mass of awareness. In terms of the individual, we can think of it as inattentional consciousness. That consciousness, for example, when you think about this meditation and so on, which is around the 500 BCE mark with the Buddha, but also before that, in which attention is turned inward and it's purely attending to consciousness itself. It's not attending to an object, it's immersed in itself. It's the turning in of attention. And then, of course, once when the world comes to be, cognition arises, there is attention too. There's a development of intentionality, a world of object. Consciousness has objects, right? And it attends to this world. We attend. And they're very, very careful that, of course, you know, the arising of these cognitive powers, they only function with attention because, of course, if we don't attend to something, it doesn't happen. So, for example, and they love the, you know, for example, if I'm seeing something, I won't really be seeing it unless my attention is focused on that particular faculty and so on, of sight. I cannot enjoy the joy of sexual union, which again is this faculty, if I'm not attending to it. Right? So attention becomes very, very important there. The Upanishads, one of the oldest texts of the Upanishads, this is about 700 BCE, this is the Great Forest Book, and it describes this particular state. It describes this particular state as having no inside and outside, as being this mass of taste, this mass of taste, this mass of awareness, right, of which we cannot define what it is, and yet it is there. So it is that savoring, that tasting, right? That phenomenological core of a reality. Okay. And from this, through this desire for tasting, arise this desire, this force, will, whatever, of tasting, there arise the five types of cognitive capacities, cognitive awareness. They're the five elemental types of awareness, solidity, liquidity, heat and so on. If we think of the world, what is our experience made up of? Why do we think this world is so real? Why do we think it really exists? Because of our felt experience. Solidity, liquidity, coldness, right? The shape here, right? This seems extremely real to me. If I pour this cold water, I'm going to feel extremely cold, right? Somebody cuts me, I will feel the pain. These are the taste of life, the taste of these cognitive organs, these capacities, that is the reality of the world, which is then conceptualized, demarcated, enacted in various ways to form this differentiated thing. If I really want to have water all the time, I'm going to then devise a mechanism by which I can make a well and take water out and so on and so forth, right? So this is how it comes to be. And from these elemental kind of awareness being, because the minute you have a kind of cognition arising at whatever primal level, even if it's without differentiation, there is some sense of being comes to be. And then as it differentiates, you have the particular kinds of sense of existence, right? So, you know, so there is, for example, just seeing, right? And then once I begin grasping particular objects of sight, certain colors, redness, they come to have a gravity, a density, a solidity, right? A beingness, an existence, right? If somebody has had a lot to drink, there is a certain lightness to our cognitions, right? The boundaries go away, it becomes much more transparent, right? Similarly, if you're in a very, very joyful state, things become lighter, there's a transparency to things. You'll still feel the pain and so on and so forth. But it will be, there's a greater transparency. The idea here is simply that our sense of existence is based on the phenomenology of consciousness, the experience of consciousness and how we experience it. All the functions and all take place in the same way, it all appears in the same way, but its sense of existence, reality, can differ. Its pull on us, its grip, its density. And this is, of course, saying that in that emptiness, that ocean of fullness, with this desire will for self-experience, it's a play. The only reason for manifestation is to experience. To experience the various tastes in this ocean of joyful intimacy, which are there. And this is, again, very sort of directed at the individual. It's basically telling us that, look, we are constantly thirsting for all these tastes. there are times when we don't have, where we're quite content, say, in deep sleep, right? Because there is still supposed to be, this is another debate in Indian philosophy, whether there is consciousness in deep sleep. We're not going to get into that. We're simply going to take it for granted that they know what they're talking about and just accept it for the time being. That there is this non-cognitive awareness and so on and so forth. This is a blissful state because there is no mind which is sort of monkeying around. The monkey mind is a great thing, you know, which is going about tasting this, tasting that, making this, making that, finding this, finding that, and, you know, proliferating this world of consumption. I mean, this is quite a good metaphor for capitalism, actually. But this is what they're talking about here. And the way that this desire is arising, this will, this force, this ardor is arising at an impersonal level, right? We can think about it personally as well. There's a homology there. But the way it's arising is that it's not just, it's both, it's a composite or a sort of a merging, a synthesis. It's both affections, emotions like desire and ardor and passion and so on. It's also sort of material things. It's heat. It's light. But it's also the light of cognition. It's both mentality and materiality because it is prior to the separation. So this is the power that is arising, the force that's arising. So it says that, and this is the arising of mind in a more local sense, a more condensed and concrete sense. Right? We can talk about that original one as the origin, as primordial mind, but this is the more what we think more of as the mind, the arising of all cognitive powers and so on and so forth. So from this mind, this condensed desire as it spills forth, as this world of cognitive objects, from this mind there comes desire for all the objects. And with this, of course, there is a proliferation of the world of names and forms, as they call it. How does this proliferation take place? Cognitive activity, names and forms. Now, what they're saying here is that these faculties, and, you know, includes all our faculties, speaking, thinking, seeing, as we speak, we call it speech. This is at a more impersonal level. It's not at an individual level, right? They're talking about as a prior to the individual. In the act of speaking, it calls itself speech. In the act of seeing, it calls itself sight and hearing, audition, when breathing, breath, and so on. So this is what is meant by an activism here, that there is a naming and forming, a self-conceiving in the very process of acting. Conceives itself at name and form. It posits itself as an object and it names it. Right? Names it, conceives it. And this what is named and conceived is all these powers we have, our locomotor powers, physiological powers, respiratory powers, and so on, various kinds of cognitive powers, sensory powers. And through this, we have all these cognitive tastes, which are generated, sight, sound, smell, and pleasure. They never stop talking about pleasure, right? This is, of course, we get pleasure every time we consume something, that piece of chocolate cake, everything else, you know, hearing a beautiful piece of music. So we cannot really separate the taste from knowing. We cannot separate pleasure and knowledge, basically, even in this differentiated world. We do, but if we're looking to truth, to reality, a deeper investigation, then these must meet. Why does all this arise? Well, it arises for its own sake, for the sake of experiencing itself in all these different forms. And this is something which tells us about how we are. We do this for our own sake. Right? We keep creating our lives. You know, we're busy doing this and that to satisfy, to fill up the sense of lack. Right? We're not fully satisfied. We're not in that state of total self-intimacy, which is a state of rest, of joy, which you get temporarily when you start consuming. When you eat, you fill yourself up. You go and buy lots of clothes, you fill yourself up, you feel a bit happier, whatever. You have sex or whatever, people feel happier. They have a drink and so on. But there is a constant lack, a constant hunger, and they're looking to move beyond that. How do you get to that point where you're not constantly consuming to fill yourself up and feel whole? Right? When you can accept that empty wholeness as a fullness and not just as this kind of fractured, differentiated and fractured sense of lack, which is limited by defining ourselves simply in terms of certain objects and subjects and so on and so forth. So you have to go in a bit. Okay. Now, in this process of arising, of course, trying to see itself, to experience itself, and so on, the one reality, whatever, consciousness, it becomes concealed. And, you know, this idea of concealment, you come across time and time again in Indian philosophy, the two truths, you know, the ultimate is concealed by the conventional. That sort of thing. You see it in Buddhism, you see it in all the other schools. So there's a concealment of the self, there's a lack of self-recognition because it gets concealed and hidden in the opacity of the objects of the world, right? You lose yourself. You no longer know who you really are. Yeah, we think we're these limited things and we're unhappy. Right? We think that we're going to die and so on and so forth and not too happy about that, or we identify with various things, we're limited. And not incredibly happy creatures most of the time. And we try to fulfill that, to get to become happier, enjoyment through various kinds of filling up, consuming, consumption. So that's the nature of consumption. This world is eater and eaten. It's a world of consumption and producing to consume, to fill ourselves up, because we're never happy, never satiated. It's a world of disintegration and death. It's never enough. We're just staving off death. We're staving off disintegration by constantly eating, or what, in various ways, through our senses and so on. And this is only a temporary resolution, right? Social pleasures are consumed, sexual pleasures are consumed, sensory pleasures are consumed, and so on and so forth. So, to move beyond this, we need to do a bit of investigation, and after all the paraphernalia, everything has been, you know, we've learned the philosophical, whatever we need to learn philosophically, then we start investigating, and it says that searching in their hearts, these poet philosophers found the connection of the manifest in the unmanifest, which was, you know, so again, that which is manifest, this whole world, is found in the unmanifest, which is that, which is actually the connection between the world and which is the manifest, and the unmanifest is the mind. Right? So they're delving in, they're coming to know the mind, as a bundle of thoughts, a bundle of cognitive capacities and so on, and they're coming to see that everything is constituted of this. Everything is made up of this. So by knowing one thing, we can know all. You know, this is the kind of, it's called a rule of substitution, we don't need to go into that. But we need to come to understand the mind as the connecting link between the world and the manifest world and that which is the unmanifest from within which everything arises and which pervades everything, which is neither nor mind or matter or anything else. It is the source of it, the origin of it. But it remains that, because of course there is no substance and so on apart from what is experienced, what is felt, right? The taste, right? So all these things are substantive. They can be measured, they can be cut up, they can be defined, but they are nevertheless, they belong to the world of cognition, right? And so the entire idea of this poetic verses, this questioning, and the Vedic texts are in fact philosophical texts which are enacted, they participate in this philosophical discourse, these competitions, and so on and so forth. They urge the listener, the poet philosopher who's doing the investigating and is being prompted to do so, to investigate within, to know the connections with the outside, and come up with those homological links through which self and world arise. And finding and making those links is both an act of knowledge, of cognition, but it's also phenomenological after that. It's a taste. And it is quite blissful. And you can see, for example, even when you listen to music, you know, when the right notes are there, it's a source of pleasure. So you can think about it. So the truth and the rightness is also pleasurable, right? It's called rhythm. It's the regularities, the rhythms, the way life moves, the way it's measured out. Finding the right ones is a source of pleasure. Knowledge is pleasure. All right? And, of course, this is, the description of the true self and so on, that, look, the closest analogy we have is of a man embraced by a woman, and don't forget this is a male-centered, these are all male philosophers, so a man who's in the embrace of a woman feels the sense of bliss, and when everything else has dissolved away, and this is that knowledge, that sensitive core from of bliss, but also awareness and knowing, which is closest to a degree to experiencing the true self, the true reality, which is, now this reality has two aspects, that, you know, it's there in that first quote that we looked at. There is the self aspect, which is, again, that same sensitivity, and the wider Brahman aspect, the Atman, which is the self, and the wider vastness, which is Brahman. These two are the same. They're twins. So again, self and world, it's that twin intimacy of taste, which we finally come to through this investigation. What they mean by investigating the heart is this phenomenological core, the experiential core of consciousness, right? This is not talking about the brain. When you dive in and you begin to explore awareness, your own consciousness, move beyond that. In today's terminology, it would be through mindfulness and meditation, so on and so forth. They engage in a bit of that, but not only that. Then you come to this phenomenological core, this experiential core, that is the heart. And you come across this, of course, in Christianity and other things as well. And so we come to, so we're going backwards, reversing the steps of manifestation through this understanding of how the world comes to be. It's enacted in a certain way, and we enact in reverse, but we build better worlds, not the one that we have found ourselves in. Yeah? And yes, and the way we do this is by going from desiring objects to not desiring objects, in fact, to consenting to death and disintegration. Because it's only by consenting to it, it's something which reminds me of Simone Weil, there has to be a consent to death. We cannot go into this in detail, but consent to limitation, to change, to illness, to impermanence, as the Buddha would say. So all of this consent, we're willing to go along with it, and then only are we able to move into its depths. And its depths are, of course, not disintegrative. It is deathless. And so on. Okay. So reverse. And that's how we come to that intimate identity with all things, because there are various practices through which we come to a certain intimate identity and empathy with all beings, with all living beings. We have to, because you cannot know this entirety without that intimate identity, without knowing the core. So it requires empathy with all beings. They're coming to this experiential identity with things. There is no difference in that sense. Yeah. But that's another level of experience. It does not mean that in everyday life you don't go about distinguishing. It's a different kind of realization which allows you to construct different sorts of bodies and worlds for yourself, which you will get into. The entire idea here is how knowledge and pleasure, intimacy and taste, and so on, are united, linked at the deepest core, and this does not detract from or prevent us from engaging in measurement, engaging in science, or engaging in art separately, but to really come to know the core of it, and also something which is to know anything about ethics deeply or aesthetics deeply, or to be really happy, we need to access that inner core of ourselves and of the world, which is that merging of the two, which is beyond knowledge and pleasure. It is both. It is intimate bliss.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.